Good morning, everyone. So welcome to this pre-lunch session. I hope you all are still fairly awake and not too hungry yet. So Rendani Mbovu will now take us through a kind of workshop on how to unlock your non-traditional data for risk analytics. So please welcome Rendani.
Thank you, Lucas. So the topic of this talk is really about using data that we have not used or we're not traditionally used to as actuaries. And this is data such as speech, text, and images, and really trying to look at ways in which we can start incorporating such data sets into our modeling experiences and our modeling techniques as we do. And for example, there's an American insurer called State Farm, and they were trying to figure out whether their short-term insurance, they wanted to figure out whether someone is distracted or not when they're driving. And what they did there, they used dash cam images. And through those dash cam images, they wanted, they put this as a Kaggle competition to detect whether, based on the image, you could build an algorithm or basically build a model that says, given this image, the driver is distracted. And that's quite important for stuff like long-haul driving, where the risk of an accident is quite, could lead to very large losses. So if you know your driver is distracted, if you had a system to detect that, that could be good, especially for you as an insurer as well. For example, if you're looking at text, what if you could look at the contents of an accident report? And given what's written in the text, you could detect whether this was a fraudulent claim or perhaps something you can look at. So really, my point of my presentation and the exercise is really allowing us to then go through the journey of going from a text or an image into a model that's predictive of risks such as the ones I've just mentioned. So the way we're going to do it is we're going to talk a little bit about the framework in which we're going to do our thinking. So it's going to be around, how you model systems, and really it's really within the same framework as we do our traditional regressions. And then we're going to talk about how you design a machine learning solution, how you, you go from rating factors or features into a predictive model. And then from there, we'll go to, the types of data sets that we want to focus on today, which is really around images, text, and speech. And then I'll give some example of some of the work that I've done with this, with some of these data sets. And from there, we'll have a short discussion, and I'll take you through some of the tutorial. If any of you registered, the page has not been updated to include the instructions for doing the modeling exercise. Apologies about that. So just about, as we've already gone through some of the context, we will take you through the rationale of how we build the systems, and from there we'll talk about the different types of data sets, go through some examples, and then we'll have a short discussion. And from there we'll look through the tutorial. So really, any sort of modeling exercise, we're trying to model systems. Really, we can consider any sort of process. For example, an accident process in sort of like short-term insurance, you're really trying to model an underlying system that results in accidents arising. And when you model such a process, you have potentially there's some inputs that go into that model, and some of them you know, but sometimes you'll have to look at proxies for those inputs. So that's when we talk about rating factors, where perhaps the entire functional form of the process that you're trying to model, it's not tractable, or sometimes even you do not know the exact inputs, but you can know some of the proxies. And we do that, we fit some sort of a model, which could be some expectation of what we're trying to model, and from there we have some sort of error term because we do not know the exact process. And when we do that, we use data as representative of the information that we know about that process. So what goes into that process and what comes out of it. And really our training data set or fitting data set is really what encapsulates our understanding of that relationship between the inputs to that process as well as the output. So that's when we talk about training, even fitting GLMs. That's what we traditionally do. So this is the systems modeling framework is what we already used to doing. So again, as we've already said, some of the principles we're already using now. In life insurance, you're trying to model, the probability of someone, the life and death process using some rating factors or features that one would look at, the smoking, the age of the person and such. And in short-term insurance, you're looking at, the accident process again, and then you have your proxies or your features there again. It should be something like your age and other information such as credit score. And then if you're now going to the realm of non-traditional data, You want to find out if someone is distracted as a function of some, again, representative features of, you know, what is exactly in the image. And we're going to talk particularly about things like that, wherein you, what transformations of an image would you use as a proxy for what is actually contained in that image. So if we're talking about sort of like a machine learning pipeline and how, what sort of ingredients you would need to build such a system for you to go from, you know, your proxies of your process to a predictive model that acts on such. So you, as you already know, we'll need our features and rating factors, and that's what we're going to talk about designing. And then you have a learning machine, and this is an algorithm that helps you to approximate the outputs of the process, and really it optimizes, you know, your approximation. So this could be, a learning machine could be anything from you know, a logistic regression model to something as complex as a neural network. And then from there, using your features and your learning machine, you can then get to your approximations, be it a classification or regression exercise. So one of the popular learning machines, the neural network, and which is really a series of nonlinear propagations of your inputs or your rating factors or your features through a series of nonlinearities, and then you get an output, and that output, in this case, the nonlinear transformation that you're performing is just a hyperbolic tangent. And when you get your output, you're trying to, you'll then train it to optimally predict, you know, the actual outputs of the system. So when you have this, the way you train your learning machine is really minimizing the distance between the output of your learning machine and the true values of what you're seeing. So that's coming from your training data set, and that's representative of what you've sampled from the process thus far. And in something as complex as, and you know, when you're doing an optimization, so you're minimizing the error of your training, of your learning machine, you have to use gradients. And usually then you attribute the gradients of each parameter in order to minimize this error between what your learning machine is predicting and what you, how your system, or what you've sampled from your actual system. And then, obviously, if you're using something as complex as a neural network, it's a composite function because you propagate the inputs through different nonlinearities. So therefore, you have to use chain rule, as we know from calculus, and then you attribute that error and you descend through the error curve until you get to a minimum and an optimum basis. So now that we know the framework or the systems that we are going to put sort of our features or rating factors into, we're then going to talk about, you know, how you then extract such information or representative features from the non-traditional data. Firstly, if we're talking about images, digital image is really a matrix of light intensities in the pixels. So the pixels represent, in a color image, it will be three matrices. It will be one that represents the color intensity in red, the other one in blue, and the other one in green. So once you have that, the content of the image is really described by how those light intensities change in that matrix. And therefore, when you have that matrix, the gradient information of that matrix helps you to then have representative features of what is in your image. So an example of how, you know, you would use such gradients, this is a simple black and white image. And really, light intensity is maximum when it's pure white light in, black, in a black and white realm. And then when it's black, it's minimum. So then when you look at, you know, the light intensity function, it obviously, as it transitions from white light to black light, it goes to a minimum. And the gradient information there really tells you where the inflection points are. So in an image, it will tell you where the curves are, where the shapes are. And typically in computer vision, we call them edges. And the edges really tell you what the content of that image is. So if you were to look at an image, you would like to represent it by the distribution of gradients within that image. So for example, this is something that you, to illustrate the value of gradients. So this is a picture of Usain Bolt. And then if you take the, just the gradients in the horizontal and vertical, and you sort of like render them as an image, you actually get the outlines of the exact positions where, you know, Usain is and the shapes that are in the image. So using the gradient information, you can learn a lot about what's in the image without considering a lot of data. So the way you would like to represent an image for a modeling exercise is something called a histogram-oriented gradient. And really, it's about looking, calculating horizontal and vertical gradients. So really, you're changing, you're seeing how light is changing going horizontally and going vertically in the image. When you do that, because you've got the horizontal and vertical changes of light, you can actually use your normal trigonometry like an arctangent to find out what the angle of the change in light is happening. So what you do when you go through the image, you will then have, you know, the magnitude of the gradient, how much the norm of the two horizontal and verticals, how much the light is changing, and then you'll also have the angle from your normal trigonometry. So in the image, you'll then represent it looking at, you know, the gradient magnitudes as well as the directions. And then from there, you want to then have a vector that represents that image in a compressed form. So what you'll do then, you will build a simple histogram, and that's how you illustrate distributions. It's really about how light changes are distributed in that image, and that will help you represent that. So what you'll do is that you will bin the angles of the what you see in those gradient directions, and then the contribution of each angle will be represented by the magnitude of that gradient. So thus, basically, then you'd have if an angle of 80 degrees there and is a magnitude of 2, it will contribute its weight there, and that will be a representative of that image. So now that you have this vector, which is basically a histogram, you can then represent your image in a high-dimensional space, and you can start putting it through your learning machine, and then you can start discriminating. So, for example, if you have cars of different shapes, you can then, each of them will lie at a different point within that high-dimensional space of histograms, and therefore you can start, you can build, your decision boundary around that if you're trying to discriminate between things. So now that we've sort of like talked about images, we're going to talk about a simple representation of how you would vectorize text. So text, really, I mean, in any sort of like modeling algorithm, you need your inputs to be in some form of, dimensional form or vectorized form. So the way you would, say, for example, you've got three documents, and documents could be anything from a line, a tweet, or even an email. And really, say you've got these three documents. One says, John likes to watch movies, and the other one says Mary likes the two. You want to create, to vectorize that, you want to create a vocabulary of, the representative words or universe of words that you would like to see. And then each document will be represented by how much of those words in that vocabulary are there, and therefore that's the way you vectorize. So basically, you would sort of like the dimension side, or the columns in your matrix is really a universe of words, and you can filter some of those which you feel sometimes are more common, and some of them perhaps are not particular to the exercise. So this, for example, this sentence, the first sentence is really, or the first document, is represented really by, again, how much representation is John getting. So if you're going to sort of like build this into your modeling exercise, you want to then vectorize the documents in this particular way. And this is called a bag of words, or sometimes a document term matrix. And you can also do counts in multiple forms. So if you're doing counts here in singular form, it's called a unigram. And then if you're looking at two words at a time, so for example, you want to, instead of doing a count of John, you want to do a count of John likes, that's called a bigram. And you can also find your document representation in that way. And that helps sometimes, especially in reducing some of the dimensionality. And this is really the techniques that we use here in text, is what's in the tutorial for the workshop. And then now we're going to talk about speech. Speech is quite special because it's a bit technical in the sense that we need to think about some signal processing. But what really happens is that a sound wave is really the amount of energy that is being pushed through the atmosphere based on vibration. For example, if you're speaking, your lips create a vibration, and that's really the energy that's those vibrations or sound particles that happen. So when you sort of like a microphone would get the speech signal, which is really the energy at different points in time. So the way we process speech is using an interesting result which was found by Joseph Fourier, which says you can represent any signal or function as a sum of components of sine waves. So you can represent any function using a linear combination of sine waves. So basically, if you're looking at a speech signal, you can tell a lot about what's being said in a speech signal by looking at the frequency content. So basically, Fourier transform will allow us to have different sine waves or different frequencies that approximate the signal. And therefore, by looking at those frequency contents, we can therefore tell a lot about what it says. And sometimes, because the speech signal is quite dense and not statistically stationary, we usually, if we're doing a word recognition or a speech recognizer, you want to sort of window it and break it down to small segments such that you can process it when stationary. And then you normally don't look at words, but look at phonemes or sometimes subphonemes because of the density of the data you're getting. So the features that are really state-of-the-art in what most speech recognizers are using is something called mal-frequency capsule coefficients. And this really, you get a speech signal, and what you do, you want to take it into a Fourier domain or find the frequency content of that signal. So you'll do some windowing to break it down into little parts, and then for each little part, you will take the Fourier transform. And once you have the Fourier transform, because it actually uses Euler's formula, it's a complex expression, you want to actually just get the magnitude, which will represent the amount of energy within each frequency. So once you have that, there's just a small later transformation to turn it into some understanding of how we perceive speech, we perceive sound. So the human brain processes sound logarithmically, in the sense that it's called a mal-frequency space, which basically says, you know, there comes a certain point where if the volume goes up, you cannot tell linearly the differences in how much it's going up. So then for us to then use it in something like, you know, speech recognition, we will then have to transform into the mal-frequency space, and that's really a logarithmic transformation. And from there, once you do that, you can then just take a cosine transform, which is really just a PCA. And it's going to tell you how much energy is attributed to each frequency. And that those coefficients are what represent the speech signal. So that's really, you know, building it out. So it really, you will represent a speech signal by a list of coefficients that represents the energy content in different frequencies. So I thought it would be relevant to talk about hidden Markov models in the context of speech, because it's a natural extension to the Markov models we see in natural literature. But hidden Markov models are an extension in the sense that you have, you know, a stochastic process which transitions through various states. But the only thing that happens, the only reason it's hidden is because you do not see the state the process is in, but you see an emission of that state. So given the state that you're in, the distribution of what you see from the process is different. And that's the exact problem we're trying to solve in speech. So for example, you want to recognize what somebody has said. The person is transitioning between saying different phonemes or parts of words, and they're going that way. And that affects then those coefficients, the distribution, because you don't observe what the person is saying, but the speech signal. So once you have those coefficients, the distribution of those coefficients, you then decode the hidden Markov model to then find out what the person is saying. And such, this sort of modeling is quite standard in speech recognition. Applications like Siri uses things like this. So after then creating those features and putting them that you'd put into your learning algorithm, how do you then, I'm going to talk about some of the examples that I've worked on using such data sets. So for example, for images, also just to for illustration of my next example, I use the different learning machine, which is an extension to the neural network I've just shown you. And this is a convolutional deep neural net. And it's quite topical in image recognition, and it's really driving this whole deep learning phenomenon. But really, in addition to the nonlinear propagations of your inputs in your neural network, there's an additional operation, which is really about spreading the pixels, the information in the pixels in the image around the image, and that actually results in some outperformance. So you'd have an operation called a convolution, which happens in the beginning, which is really a matrix of weights that weights the different color light intensities and distributes them around the image. And once you actually do this and feed that through a learning algorithm, it is shown to have quite significant outperformance in a lot of image recognition, and sort of like algorithms that are going into self-driving cars are using such architectures of neural networks. So in insurance, an example I mentioned earlier, this insurer actually put it up as a Kaggle competition. And Kaggle is an online platform where companies with sort of like analytics ideas put out for people to solve. And me and a colleague of mine, when I was doing my master's, we entered this competition back in Stockholm. And really, the idea was we had about 22,000 images, and we needed to build an algorithm to classify what the person is doing given the dashcam images. And what we did there, we used a deep neural network, as I've just shown you, and then we needed to predict about 10 classes, you know, whether the person is talking, whether they're on a cell phone, and those kind of things. But it's important to know that this was a synthetic data set, so there are some 26 actors and created those images. And when we did that, we... No, that's for the actuaries. So then what we did, we managed to get accuracy of that of around 98% using the deep neural network. But then when we started realizing that the neural network was also not necessarily picking up the action, but it also picked up significant information about the individual. So once we sort of like created a testing set that actually, because we're 26 actors, not depending on only the action, but also the actors, the accuracy dropped to like around 55%. And that's because, machines tend to overlearn, and you need to give them inputs that are representative of the entire process. So when you have a synthetic data set such as the one State Farm gave us, you need sort of like a real life setting of how this process is happening in real life. And that's one thing that could potentially improve. So we submitted this at the time of submission on this platform. We got a rank of about 184 out of about 1,000. It deteriorates with time because people submit and we've just stopped. We're just doing it for a master's project. So this is an example I've used in the exercise that is on the webpage that if you registered, you've seen. And here is using text. I used the same features of text, vectorizing them using counts. And here we're trying to classify movie reviews. IMDb is a popular website where people give movies ratings. And basically, based on the content of that review, so the words that are said in that review, the task was to predict whether there was a positive, i.e. the rating was greater than 7, and then if it's negative, the rating was less than 5. So I used a simple logistic regression model. So I vectorized the documents, as I just mentioned, and then put this through a logistic regression. And these are some of the, so I used, firstly, I built a model based on unigrams, i.e. counts of single words. And then if you do this, I test the different cutoffs of just the probability that the GLM gives. And around there, you get an accuracy of around 80, I think it's about 82%, and you'll see in the exercise. And if I use bigrams, actually, so this accounts of two words. The accuracy there got to about 70%. So it seemed like singular words were actually more telling than looking at combinations of them. And you'll see when you look at some of the coefficients. So once I fit those models, I just looked at, the highest positive and the highest negative coefficients, so the ones that were most likely associated with a positive review and the ones that were most likely associated with a negative review. For example, if you look at, this is the top coefficient, so the ones that push the probability of having a positive review, you see words like enjoyable, excellent. And so those words are quite telling of what the review outcome would be. And then for the negative ones, you can see worst, awful, dull, waste, poorly, and a mess. So it's always we're doing this, and it's not in such exercise. When you use a GLM, which we know how to interpret, you can then see why some of those decisions are made. And looking at the combinations of words, so this is a bigram. And here you can see some people were actually, in their reviews, wrote they're going to give it an 8. So actually those came through as well when you do the modeling. You also, highly recommend. So that helped, in pushing the review up. The negative ones, awful film, how bad, all those kind of things were coming up in as the big negative coefficients and driving that probability down. And for speech, I used the same principle, using a hidden Markov model on those MFCCs. And also, this was part of my master's program. I did it with a colleague of mine from Croatia. And really, we used the data set that Texas Instruments was trying in the early 90s to have a voice calculator. So they recorded a whole group of people giving, numbers 0 to 9, as well as O, I think, because you say 9-0 and something like that. So they add that as well. And then what we did, we had about 8,000 utterances, put it through hidden Markov model, and the emissions, it could be any distribution. So given, the state that you're in, the emission could be Gaussian, or some, and those parameters, the mean and the variance, depend on the state that you're in. But here, which is the state of the art in speech recognition these days, you actually model the emission distribution using a neural network. So what we did there, we got about an accuracy of around 95%. And this is actually the confusion matrix. And given that it was a small sample and actually the words were quite distinct and representative, we got quite good accuracy there. So just to round it up, so I think this are good, techniques and methods perhaps for us to start incorporating in an actuarial toolbox. And perhaps, as we've talked about, it could be used fundamentally in developing new products. How do you interact with your customer? How do you, detect fraud perhaps in claims? How do you build a product that incorporates, distracted driving? How do you, perhaps, include a lot more open text to analyze, operational environment system notes in a way that you can start building, predictive models using the data set that you're generating from there and start, making full use of the data. And I think stuff like neural networks is really a natural extension of current techniques. I mean, neural network is really, a logistic regression with more than one node. So it's really, just combining those, logic transformations into more than one and weighting them further. So it's really, a natural extension to what we already know. And from my experience, a lot of computer scientists, I don't know if there are any in the room, and engineers, they have a very strong programming background. But really what's driving this underlyingly is really the statistical context. And really we as actuarists can contribute there a lot. And really, when you're using the more complex algorithms, you get superior accuracy. But how do we have that debate around accuracy and interpretation? And there's a lot of research work that's going on there. But really, how much of it, and that's, especially in the actuarial realm, where perhaps we need to then find, that trade-off between accuracy and interpretation. And some of the, the more companies that, big in machine learning and using data, there's this concept, and the results that I've shown are based on running the algorithm that I've trained on a separate unseen test set. And when they do that, for example, Google, if they have a complicated translation machine, the way they test it is how it performs on an unseen data set, because they can't explain it, there's so many parameters. But if you can get within some level of company confidence how it performs on a testing set, that could be a way for us to use as a way of getting comfort in the level of generalization you can get from such models. So again, perhaps there are some areas where we could start experimenting. So that's really what I'd like to convey from just the work that I've done. And from there, we will go through the movie review exercise. If the webpage is now up with that, and I'll just go through it on screen, just talk about how you would go from transforming the text to something. But I think before we go there, I can open it up to questions. Peter, sorry?
Sorry, so...
ask your question again.
Right, so this presentation was great. This presentation was not great. Okay, when I vectorize that, I end up with this one extra word which changed my rating from 2 out of 10 to 9 out of 10.
Oh, sorry, I thought that was... I was like...
how do you allow for that... How do you allow for that... The addition of that one extra word which changes the meaning... Completely. And if I thought, if I think about what you had there, mm-hmm. the word "great" had a certain weighting.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
so how do you deal with the negatives?
So you have two vectors. One that says "not" at zero, zero count, and the other one says "not" at one. And therefore, you have a result that says, well, when you're training, so you have the, whether the reviewer is positive or negative. And when you fit your GLM just like any other, it will give a negative weight to "not," which will pull down, and given perhaps all those reviews that you're getting in your data are representative. It will therefore give a negative review in terms of it's more likely to be negative given the presence of the word not. So.
Yeah.
That was a close one.
Sorry, just a bit related. I guess it's also how do you deal with typos and people that don't use spacing and commas instead of spacing. Do you guys have like some sort of spell check algorithm that converts the data into sensible words first and then...
Yeah. So as you'll see in the tutorial, we usually tokenize the words. So basically, tokenize them is it means you look at the spaces and break down and you do the distinct count. And usually, you also do lowercase, such that the same word is done. And then that's all in the tutorial. And sometimes you have. I mean, those kind of errors, if they're coming through, unfortunately, unless you prune your, we'll do some pruning. So sometimes if you have a long list of words, you might say, because, for example, in the exercise we're looking, you might have 6,000 distinct words, but say you want to narrow it down to the top 2,000. So those errors that arise when you narrow it down, you can let go of. So any more questions?
Sorry, you mentioned that like during the study you guys did on the different drivers and stuff, what additional information did you guys gather around like the, what additional information was gathered around the driver's patterns, given if they're drinking or like on their cell phones, etc.?
Yeah, so the model only made a decision on the basis of the image. So that's, it's almost, if you're deploying such a solution, it'll almost be at a real-time basis. So the model is constantly, you know, taking, you know, because videos, again, are just a series of frames of images. So when you, it'll go through a series of those frames and then run the algorithm, find the probability of someone, you know, being distracted or being in one of those other classes, and therefore it will trigger something. So we didn't, and you can incorporate that. You can build that in as well. But we only looked at images.
Just a bit broader. Mm-hmm. It's often been expressed that this machine learning and so on would take our jobs. How likely do you think that it would happen? And what role do we have or can we play in either slowing that down or actually accelerating it?
Come on, Rosanne, I'm just an average guy talking about this stuff. But I think for me, what I've seen as well, spending time with people from different disciplines, is the fact that, you know, the algorithms are great, but it's really seeing, but a neural network will never deploy itself, will never find a solution to a problem. You will say you want to use a, so what actuaries, I think we should do is identify the business value of different algorithms. So it first comes from understanding them, what they can do and what they cannot do, and where in our business want to deploy them. So it's not going to be, you know, there's not going to be a lot of time we spend on, you know, processing data, on sort of like, you know, competing on processing models and stuff. But really, our work is really about, you know, specifying, giving, you know, some specification to some, to a problem wherein you accurately design those inputs, because the inputs are quite important. If you have terrible inputs, you're going to get a wrong result. So us is actually understanding the process and specifying it well enough for the AI. And I think that's still going to be an ongoing task for people to do. Yeah, we'll have to evolve slightly, but yeah.
Thank you for the presentation. Mm-hmm. So how do you think we can implement this into like actuarial education? Is it practical to put it as an extra subject or to include it in the syllabus somehow?
Okay, so being in academia, I've seen now the curriculum 2019 from the UK. And they have started, I think, some of the exercises and actually some of the exams, some of the CT exams, you're going to have to do some exercises in R. And some of them are around building decision trees and neural networks. So from 2019, it's going to be in. But my feeling is that some of it is a little bit behind current trends. But at least you don't necessarily need to know everything when you're studying, but you know, you have to know where it goes to and what it can do. So I think that being added will give some additional platform for actuaries to perhaps start experimenting with this as well. Yeah, so it's in the syllabus. Okay, how are we doing for time? Are we good? Okay, so this is sort of like a notebook on how I sort of like went about building the models for the movie review datasets. So these are some of the preliminaries. I don't know, when you're now working in a university, you become very instructive. So this was some of the packages that I used, and I'll keep this web page up for at least a month, and then it'll go. The library that is used in R to vectorize, and when you look at the code, R is not really my first language, but I used it because it's easily portable and used in Windows, but we do solve the problem. But the R package that does the text vectorization is a package called Text2Vec. So this is just the loading of the packages. And the data set was about 5,000 reviews. I used 3,500 of them for training, for fitting the model, and I used the remaining 1,500 to test it, and that's where I sort of look at it. The specification of the data set, and this data set is publicly available, less than 5 was a rating of, was a negative review, and greater than 7 was a positive review, and that was 1. So here, some pre-processing that we did. If you want to look at it through, if you cannot see, you can perhaps look at it over your phone, or I can show the link to the tutorial again. But so here we really loading the data set and using what is called regular expressions to trim some of the stuff, because some of the text actually, this actually means that you're going into a next line. So some of these things might be, and this is some nuisance sort of like things you could find in the text. So you sort of like, you know, remove that. So you also remove some punctuations as well. And this is just now, you know, sampling 3,500. And then this was just, you know, getting the remaining 1,500. And this is what the data set sort of looked like. So you have a review ID, and then from there you have the sentiment, which is 1 or 0, whether it was positive or negative. And the text was something like this. So someone writes an essay, you know, after success of part 4 was a natural. Okay, so I won't read it out, I'm a bad reader. But really, these are the words that we're vectorizing for different documents. So when you, after, when you, so this might be a bit, let's do this. Then we start doing our vectorization. So I put some stop words, and stop words are words that you want to filter out in building your algorithm. So these are some of the words that are, you know, words like there, some prepositions, and those kind of things. So I remove them because they sometimes inflate the count, and really want words that are telling what the review, whether the review is going to go, you know, south or it's going to be a very good one. And then from there, you then tokenize, which is then again just building distinct, you know, distinct words, or then for you to create that vocabulary. And then this vocab operation, create vocabulary, is again, you know, create, you know, find the distinct words while removing the stop words, and that's what this operation was doing. Then I did, and I think we talked about some of the errors. So I did what is called pruning, and really I said, well, if the word is going to occur in my vocabulary, it must occur at least in all those documents or all those reviews at least 10 times. And if it's overrepresentative, also I actually left it out. So it must be, its document proportion was limited at 95% and other parameters. And I also said I needed a maximum of 1,000 words in my vocabulary. Then from there, I then basically sort of like indexed each of the distinct words. And then from there, I then create, and this operation creates the bag of words or the date or the document term matrix, and that's really, you know, these are the tokenized training sets, and this is the vectorizer. So just then to link it to those distinct words and do the counting. So once we have that, so we're just checking the dimensions. I mean, I had 3,500 and by 1,000 because my vocabulary is 1,000. And just to check now, you know, my document term matrix. So it's, you know, the review ID, and then this is just now the each of the words, and then how it's vectorized and the counts. And then from there, it was I did a normalizing operation, and this just says to make sure each document, so all those counts, just basically normalize them to sum to one. So basically, each is just a proportion of its representation in the document. And then from there, this is just a GLM training. It's using a GLM match. So I put the training set into the GLM, and then from there, I basically now just vectorize the testing set, because I've vectorized the training set, so this was vectorizing the testing, the same operations that we've done already. So this was then taking the vectorized testing set and putting it through the classifier, so it's basically making predictions on the new vectorized test set. And the next operations are just around calculating, you know, performance, you know, stuff around, this is the accuracy, 81.9%, and then there's the area under the curve for the ROC curve. And that's how, using that, we plot the accuracy using, so that the 81% is really the maximum, usually around. Because sometimes you find, I once worked at a company where when we're modeling some of the risks, they didn't experience them such an extent that you cannot use a cutoff of 0.5. If you want your model to be discriminative, you want to, you know, look at lower cutoffs. That's really, we got, but I think our maximum was around 0.5. And then the rest was just producing the receiver operating characteristic curve, which is really again your true positive rate versus your false positive rate. And really you always want your true positives to grow higher than your false positives, and that's what we get here. And really that was just an introductory exercise to this. So I think I repeat the same exercise for bigrams, which is really the same principles. And these are the coefficients you get. So basically looking at the top 20 coefficients, I used 10 there, but yeah, it's really how you get those from the model as well. And I repeated this for higher order n-grams. So this was, bigram, so the pairs of words counts. And that was really the exercise. So I think you can go look at the link if you're interested. But yeah, this is the end of the workshop. Thank you for listening. Yeah. Any more questions?
Hi. I was just curious, one possible use case which you probably already have experience in, but how good is the technology at listening to a voice conversation between a call center advisor and a client and telling whether the client perhaps had some emotions, was upset? To sort of scan yes. through those conversations.
Yeah, so that will definitely come through the MFCCs. And when you build such systems, you want annotated examples. So you would perhaps, a client case or some sort of, servicing query that someone put in and there's a complaint. And then when you want to build your training set to build the technology, you will map that to what happened in the call. So if you had a case, it's a complaint. So that's a one. And then you also need to keep the ones where everything went well. And that will go into building this model. I've seen, I think, in the UK where they're using such things to detect cases of mis-selling. So based on sort of like, the MFCC, you can tell some sort of, whether someone is making, again, you can, based on what, on the cases you've already seen, you can start mapping, those features to the outcome.
Thanks.
Great presentation, Rendanim. I just want to check, you said it yourself that R is not your first language. Uh-huh. But what other statistical software packages that you find being used on the market for such work?
Yeah, so my first computing language, I have to state, is Python. So Python, I think, works quite well. And it's really well developed and works slightly faster than R. MATLAB also can be used. Because I was a student, I shied away from some of the commercial softwares. But you can get a lot done. And it's, if you make decisions at your organization, perhaps look at how much you can get done with R and Python before getting a license of something expensive. But sometimes it could mean additional lines of code. But some of these things, they're actually as packaged as you'd see in commercial software. So I think R and Python are doing well in this sector.
Okay. So if there's no further questions, we can almost break for lunch. So thank you very much, Rendani. Please remember to rate your speakers on the app. And then just one final announcement. So due to the huge popularity of Nene Molefi's Developing the Skill of Inclusion workshop, they've extended the venue to accommodate a few more people during that session today. So if you have registered already, you'll be given preference there. But if you haven't, you can still attend, but it's first come, first serve during that session. So if you want to attend, please leave your details at the registration desk during the course of the day. So we'll then break for lunch. So I think we're a bit early. So thank you very much, Rendani.